Next on our list is Sam. Do you have a question tonight, or are we just kind of checking in?
I have a question tonight.
Okay, very good. What's your question?
Glass mount amateur radio antennas. Dual band 144 and 440 megahertz. You mount the antenna on one side of the glass and the other piece on the other side of the glass. Are you familiar with these types of situations for mobile use? I'm curious about your opinion and how it works.
Yeah, I'm familiar with them. They operate in a similar way to magnetic mounts for the car. They use capacitive coupling. They don't have a direct electrical connection, except that the base, it's usually either it's a glue or it's a magnet. And the magnetic mount is one side of the capacitor that's coupled, and what you put on the other side of the glass is the other plate of the capacitor. And so by capacitively coupling the antenna, you're supplying the signal through the capacitor. They work fine.
Thank you very much for that. that was my question of the evening.
Okay, very good. Thank you for your participation. Once again, I am AC2GS. My name is Roy, and this is the Limark Technical Net. We got lots and lots of time, so I hope we get lots and lots of more questions. If anyone has any questions or comments or topics for tonight, feel free, hit that push to talk and give me your first name, your call sign, whether it's amateur radio related or just science and technology.
KG2RY, good evening.
Good evening, David. What can I do you for?
Well, this is sort of like it's a continuation of what we discussed on the 10-meter KCRC net. My question is, they say use it or lose it. What modes are the most obvious for people who would judge, you know, activity on the bands? And is the result of losing it digital ham radio? Go ahead.
Okay, I don't think digital ham radio is losing anything. Sometimes I tend to think it's somewhat balkanizing our hobby, because the digital modes are all incompatible with each other. And amateur radios, guys who can tinker and make things up have come up with M17, which is yet another digital type. It's an open source digital type, but it's another incompatible digital type. And so, you know, you find yourself in the unfortunate situation that if you want to talk on a fusion repeater or a fusion room, you need a Yaesu radio. If you want to do, if you want to talk on a reflector, you need an ICOM digital technology radio. If you want to talk on talk groups, you need a DMR type of radio. So I don't like the fact that it splinters our group much more than it's ever been splintered. I mean, it happens occasionally. It upset a lot of AM people back in the 50s when single sideband became a thing, and they had to decide whether or not to invest in a new radio or to stick on AM for the long haul. But that, you know, that only kind of split people in two. With digital modes, you can be split into fifths and sixths and such. There's a lot of different digital technologies out there, and there seems to be more every year. I think what more that spreads out the amateur radio population are the different modes, the different bands, the sides of the bands. Because, you know, we don't all have the same interests. There are some people who really, really like FT8, and so that's the side of the bands you'll see them in. Other people love CW. Very near where FT8 hangs out, but not the same place. Some people love AM. Some people love single sideband. Some people love FM. And every mode kind of splinters our population among a broader, larger number of technologies where it's very difficult to keep an eye on how active the hobby in general is. You know, if you take a look at 80 meters, you're going to get a completely different picture of the hobby than if you listen to repeaters. So it's very difficult to kind of figure out, you know, how many people, whether it's growing, whether it's shrinking, and where they seem to be sequestered. You can do a broad investigation by just looking at FCC licenses, but, I mean, that gives you a completely false observation, because most of the, you know, there's more than 750,000 licensed amateur radio operators in the United States, but most of them only have technicians licenses, and most of them don't really operate frequently. They tend to be people who have a bowel fung or two, and they're somewhat preppers. They're either waiting for World War III or the Civil War, and so one of the things on their checklist of learning how to reload bullets and such is to get yourself an amateur radio license and a radio to have an extra band to be able to operate on. So it's very difficult to
G2RY, are you there?
Okay, hopefully I'm back again. Yeah, I'm back again. I don't know what to tell you guys. All-Star is a little wonky today. The repeater is acting strange. It keeps on having, you know, issuing this, you know, turn-on, turn-off type of a signal, so I'm not quite sure what's going on. Just in case you didn't get what I was saying before, I think it's a lot more complicated. There's a lot of different bands. Some people hang out at one end of the band, others at the other end of the band. And, you know, I mean, it goes all the way from 160 and even below it for people who are long, ultra low frequency fans, all the way up to microwaves. So that's in addition to the sundry incompatible digital modes that have hams spread out. And a large number of the licensed amateur radio operators just have a license so that they could use their Baofeng when the Civil War hits. So it's kind of difficult to figure out exactly what's going on where at all times. It's a big logistics problem that no one seems to really be working too hard on.
Do you think that digital modes could exist without most of the ham radio frequency?
Well, I mean, theoretically, yes, you just need one band, and, you know, if it's a license for digital mode, then that it can exist in that small amount. Every so often, these companies like ICOM try to generalize their UHF, VHF digital modes. They would start selling radios that are capable of using them on the HF band, but I have not one time heard anyone with using ICOM digital mode on the HF. It's almost always UHF. It's rare to find it even in VHF. So they try because they're trying to sell radios, but they fail. So it's usually, if you're looking for digital transmissions, the best place to go looking is UHF.
Like I said before, analog, you know, it's a good communication, and you can have a normal conversation with it, and it's good for emergencies. So, yeah, you know, digital, you know, you can do without ham radio and have digital. And digital, you know, if somebody would be listening to 2 meters of 440 going up and down the band of frequencies and reading repeaters, you know, the ones that are DMR and D-Star and Fusion and all, you know, just make it, it's the whole pile of noise, you know. So, yeah, I think analog.
And I sort of agree with you. I think it's a universal radio. All radios do analog for the most part. You know, they also do their own flavor of digital. But, I mean, you know, there's always exceptions to the rule. I'm sure you remember the story. It got written up, I think, in QST and in the Radio Society of Great Britain, RADCOM, when Rich N2EO fell out of his bed. And he still had, I believe, he had a Yaesu Fusion radio, and he got on to the rooms, the Wire X rooms, and contacted a ham in England, who then, you know, called the United States and called 911 and got in touch with Richie's local police department and had a police car go to his house and take care of him. So, you know, and that was international and that was digital as opposed to analog.
I remember when Richie N2EO was in the hospital, doctor was giving him a very poor bill of health. He was talking to me from his analog HT. I told him to get another opinion and see, you know, if that doctor is right or wrong.
Okay, well, I mean, Rich used a lot of different radios. Well, just pointing out that, that you know, in his particular case, it was a digital radio that was able to get the help for him. So, you know, there's always exceptions to all kinds of rules.
QSO. Yeah, yeah. I still think analog. And well, to say whatever HT you have in your hand, you know, hopefully you know how to use it.
Well, some do, some don't. Field programmable, field programming, handy talkies. Some people know exactly how to do it. Some people sort of remember how to do it. And some people don't have a clue. Yes, comment.
It's K2GJE. ARRL now is selling a book, how to program your bell phone. And in reference to the question, I don't think the FCC is keeping any track of us anymore, except to get a couple of dollars from us, unless we have some frequency that they could give to a phone company over.
Yeah, I sort of agree. They really aren't interested in keeping any kind of information about us. It's probably not that difficult to look up in the database of how many active licenses there are, though. So, I mean, occasionally we'll get that, but it probably takes an intern about, you know, an hour to get that information out of the database. But I would agree with you. Unfortunately, if the FCC could kind of kick us off to the curb, I think they'd do it in a split second.
I just say, you know, make yourselves heard, you know, so all the analog modes on all the regular ham radio bands, and we try to keep our frequencies.
Oh. I mean, unfortunately, you know, we all have noticed Repeaters are not what they once were. Nets, unfortunately, aren't what they once were. The general activity, as I perceive it, is going down. I keep a finger in the digital modes to see what might be happening. There are a lot of talk groups / reflectors / Wires X rooms out there, and so it kind of spreads it even thinner than ever before. So, you know, I end up in things like American English talk groups and such. And, you know, I've said it before, but I'll repeat it, what the hell. A lot of times it's an elderly gentleman who's a nephew or niece or grandchild has brought him an Anytone DMR and a hotspot, and this is the first time in 10 years he's been on the air because, you know, he's in a assisted living facility that doesn't allow for antennas and such. And usually the next day you hear another guy with the same story. The next day, another guy with the same story. I haven't been completely engaged by conversations on these digital places. I mean, except that they do act as a kind of funnel for nets. We talked a couple years ago about on the West Coast is the Papa Network, and one of the things that they have is an antenna net, and that's a very interesting net, and it's connected to all kinds of gateways. It's on AllStar, it's on Echolink, it's on different digital gateways as well. But again, it's kind of spreading things out, and it seems like a lot of places are fading away. 10 meters is not the most active thing in the world these days, unfortunately. That's probably due to the geomagnetic storms. But, I can't think of any particular band that all of a sudden got a second a breath, and it's as active as anything. You know, if you put on a contest, you'll be able to motivate people to go on those bands. But without a contest, they're few and far between. And, more than a few hams have gotten a little depressed about the hobby and what will become of it, because if there's no real demand for it, inevitably someone's going to figure a way to monetize it, and then it's gone.
Yeah, I think that ham radio operators would have a better, like if somebody is saying there's no action, there's no activity, you're not using it, And, even like on 20 meters, 9 or 10 o'clock at night, even though for the most part of the day it's not so active, not so much activity, but, at least there's some. And if anybody, listening to a shortwave radio with SSB built in, they can hear, what's going on 20 meters, even if it's not a lot, and even if it's later at night.
Yeah, but I tend to think there's less people like that these days. Most people are, listening to audio streams on the Internet. There's a couple of providers that offer feeds for all kinds of odd amateur radio frequencies. I remember I used to listen to West Coast repeaters, which are really, some of them are quite different than the East Coast. On the East Coast, we kind of follow the law. On the West Coast, there's so many amateur radio operators because of, I think because of the electrical engineering industries and such, as manufacturers of military electronics and such, that there's a certain percentage of them that are foul-mouthed, crazy people. And, I've listened to repeaters on the West Coast that are that type of repeater system. They use a lot of obscenities. They talk about drug use and alcohol use and all kinds of things that you would never hear from anyone here on the East Coast. So it's different cultures all over on every different band. The people on 80 are different than the people on 160, who are different than the people on 40, who are certainly different than the people on 20. And, again, the repeaters are very different types of people, and digital modes are very different types of people. So it's curious how The ham radio group has kind of separated themselves into significantly different types of people.
Well, you know, obscenities is not good for the ham radio community, you know. It was always in my mind the protocol of how to speak to somebody else on the ham radio frequency. You know, you're on the air, you know, you speak politely and friendly, and you don't use a bad word.
And yet there are places like 14.313 that were famous for foul mouth, and they would record things and play them back over and over and over again. They would insult each other. They set up websites where they made believe they were the other side, and they insulted themselves, which is insulting the other guy, actually. So it can be a mess. It took years for the FCC to get rid of 313. Ed, you wanted to say something?
Yes, different folks, different strokes, but what I've noticed lately, even tonight, there's people on 40 meters. I see 40 meters has been very active all over the last couple of months. So the only thing that I think is that the youngsters are not likable to this hobby. They're glued to their cell phones, they're glued to their computers, but I don't know if we have any data of people into the hobby by age, over.
AC2GS, I don't think so. I've never seen anything, because you don't have to put that down in the license. There's no place for your birthday or anything. So that's the only way that they would be able to extract that type of information. Yeah, I mean, you always see these, you read these articles about five-year-olds who pass their technician's licenses and such. I don't think that that's the future for our hobby. I've talked about it before, but if I had to pick a certain age category, I particularly try to get guys in their early 30s and 40s. If you get them when they're kids, it's all well and good, but very quickly they discover women and careers, and the hobby, basically goes into the closet for the next 20 years until their kids go off to college and they have a lot of free time. So you get them when they have kids already. There's nothing probably that's going to interrupt the hobby with those particular people. And I've kind of done that with the Kings County Radio Club. We have a whole bunch of guys in there, anywhere from 20-year-olds going to electrical engineering school to, 30-year-olds and 40-year-olds who are bringing up a family and working hard at their jobs. So, you know, I tend to think that that's the sweet spot, not the five-year-old that makes the articles. They're interesting stories, but I don't think that that's how you have the hobby survive.
Kilowatt Bravo 2 Delta Yankee. My name is Pete.
Yes, Pete, what can I do you for?
Hi, Roy. I've been in the hobby for a long time. I remember the day, and still to this day, where portions of the 80-meter band and 160 AM were considered gentlemen's bands. And I take that back, gentlemen's and ladies' bands. And you should see those operators operate. We got to bring that down to the bands that are used less today. Unfortunately, I read an article, and commercial entities are knocking on the FCC's door for 440 megahertz. and they want to get a portion of that band, and we got to do something to reinstill in the youth of today, and some of the gentlemen that have been on as long as I have, to get on those bands and use them like shit in the past. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, Pete, I understand your feeling. The problem always is, how do you accomplish this? You know, there's a lot of people who are just not in a situation where they can keep the radios going. They're in assisted living facilities. They're in AKOs. You know, those places with the requirement that your grass has to lean slant in a certain direction. It's a lot more difficult. And then the other options that people have for how they spend their free time, and behavior is the most difficult. It's very difficult to change people's behavior. You know, a certain generation acted in a certain way. The next generation inherently is going to act in a somewhat different way. Whether it's because they're rebelling against their parents or their grandparents or what have you. So I agree with your sentiment. I don't have a clue of how you could bring this to pass. That's my biggest problem. You know, if you have to sit down and figure out how to get it done, I have no clue how to get it done. You know, we're not empowered to do things like that. You can't change people's behavior. There have been a kind of roughening going on in the world. Things were a lot formal when I was a kid. My father used to wear a hat. Hats went the way of all things except baseball hats. You know, I mean, if you're in the hat business, I'm sure you would like to see a return to people, guys wearing hats. But I don't see it happening, at least in this particular era.
True. I understand. In trying to instill that into my children became a painstaking learning experience. I would tell them, don't you want to learn about radio, how it became, who were the big people way back when, in the early 20th century, that were, and probably late 19th century, where they were experimenting, Tesla, Marconi. Don't you just want to learn about history and maybe just pick up a little bit of it and get into the hobby and what? No. Their answer to me is, why do we want to do that? We've got computers. We've got cell phones. We've got ways to use the Wi-Fi. There's no necessity to learn that. And I tell them constantly, I beg to differ, you wouldn't have those instruments today if it weren't for the forefathers that operated way back when, way before I was born. Now, it's like banging your head against the wall. And it's sad. It really is sad. And I wish today's era could just delve a little bit into the history. Maybe it might enlighten some people to keep things the way they are and keep them solid for amateur radio. I am concerned. Thanks for listening, Roy. Oh, one other question. KRP Electronics used to be in Farmingdale. Excuse me, used to be in Freeport. Moved to Farmingdale. Are they still in existence? KB2DY.
I don't know, Pete. If anyone knows about that store, hit that push to talk.
WB2BX. So I'm pretty sure. I think you're talking about Harrison Radio and Farmingdale. I think they're long gone. I remember going out there with my dad to buy a radio from them, I think, in 1980. That was a long time ago. Go ahead.
Yeah, I would assume that they're gone as well. Unfortunately, that's the nature of these types of stores. You know, I mean, the closest amateur radio store around is HRO's satellite stores, which are, you know, states away from us. Again, it's a combination of not that much demand in this area and the ability to get there by the internet has kind of killed a lot of retail outlets. But I mean, I agree with you entirely, Pete, and I wish it was different than it is. There's a significant lack of intellectual curiosity. There are still guys out there who are very interested in how everything works, but there's a much more massive majority that just, they know how a television works. You plug it in, you turn it on. That's how it works. They don't know about the details. They don't care about the details. As long as it works, and if it doesn't work, we'll throw it out and we'll put another one on the credit card until that one doesn't work, and then we'll throw that out. So we're in a disposable, consumer-driven society with a significant amount of lack of intellectual curiosity. You know, I almost cry when I mention a book to some people, and their response, they look back at me with a kind of blank expression, and they say, oh, I don't read. Okay, you don't read.
How sad. Yes, I do remember Harrison Radio. They had a store in New York City, and they had a store out here on the island. They closed up a long time ago. Number of years after, maybe 3 or 4 years after I first got licensed. But I'm talking about KRP Electronics. I remember them when I needed parts, coax, I needed filaments, I needed wire, capacitors, resistors, any parts that I needed. They were there. They moved to Farmingdale, and since then, I don't hear much from them. Like you had said, Roy, a lot of people use the internet, and they kill the little mom-and-pop electronic stores. And KRP was like a gold mine out here on the island. And you pop over there, you need a disc value, run over there, go get it, replace it in the radio, and it works. You want to build your own antenna, get the proper feed line, get the proper wire. Always use branded 14-gauge wire for the center core because of the surface area for the electrons to run about. And it's a little bit better than a solid one. I don't know what the philosophy on that was, but that's the place I went to. And I learned, not just getting my license, not just studying, not just reading. I learned from them. Gone. I don't know where they are, if they exist anymore. And yeah, the last article I read, they're barking at 440 agacycles in commercial interest. And so it's like a little stab. And just listening by opinion, gentlemen, ladies, that's what I feel. I studied. I knew the code. I got my extra. I've done everything in the hobby. And it just hurts to see that it's not being promised or given to the future. Something has to be changed. culture has to change. Thank you for everything, Roy. Thank you, gentlemen, ladies, for listening. This is Kilo Bravo 2 Delta Yankee. The name is Steve, signing. Thank you for everything.
Okay.
Yes, Rich.
Talking about parts, first of all, that company will be, just Google the name of the company and you'll find if it's around or not, because there's no company these days that does not have a website. So just Google them and you'll have your answer. I just called McMaster Car, and not only did somebody answer the customer support line, it was a woman who spoke American English, which I couldn't believe on a Sunday night. And we went through everything. We found the two parts that I needed. They're 1-inch each, 1-inch adapters. Okay? They want $23 for the two adapters, but here's the kicker. They want $17 to ship the little 1-inch adapters. That doesn't cost more than $2 for them to ship priority. They want $17. So for two little adapters, they're $43. And maybe corporate America can pay that, but I can't, and I won't. Go ahead, Roy.
Okay, it's a different world in the business world. They just put it down and as a cost, and they make it up on their taxes and such. But, I didn't tell you it was going to come cheap. I just said that they would have it. But I'm sorry to hear that you'll have to find some other solution.
Yeah, $43 for two 1-inch adapters. No, that's a ripoff, actually, to tell you the truth. I'll take a look at fittings, but this company, yes, they had them. Yes, they had customer service Sunday night. She told me they have customer service 24/7, but $43 for two parts that cost maybe 20 cents each to make and $2 to ship. No. So, okay. Just wanted to let you know.
Okie doke, Rich. Better luck next time. Anyway, getting back to Pete. You know, it's not only amateur radio. When I was much younger, there was a local plumbing supply store, and you could kind of disassemble your plumbing and take it to these guys, and they would figure out what it was and what needed to be replaced, and send you back with a little bit more knowledge about plumbing than you had when you walked into the store. You know, I mean, they're gone. So, you know, there's a lot of mom-and-pop places where they've been in business for decades. They have a lot of expertise. They have a lot of free time to share their expertise with their customers, and that's part of the value. But they're all been eaten up by box stores and these large retail outlets, and again, that's just the nature of what's happening over time. There's kind of no way to step back in time, you know. Well, every time you step in a river, it's a different river. It's just the act of stepping in, it changes it. So, I mean, that's our future. The only thing you can depend on to be a constant is change. The future will be different than the present, because the present is different than the past. Anyway, enough with the philosophy net. Any other comments on the subject?
KD2FIU.
KB2HHU.
Yes, George and Rocco. George first.
And yes, well, the shipping and handling is going to be expensive. We understand the shipping could be anywhere from $4 to $10. Depending upon the shipper that you use. But handling. Think of what handling is with a company that handles hundreds of thousands of parts. The size of the warehouses. Is it one warehouse Is it multiple warehouses? Is there lighting? Is there phone networks in there? Do they have all types of systems to have the employees go around with Bluetooth on the head that they're paying for to say, go to this shelf in this warehouse, in this area, in this section, and find that part and bring it here and do this and that with it? These are not the mom and pop places with squeaky floors that you're expecting them to put in a bag. They have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of parts for that reason. They have massive networks within their company that is going to get it out the door immediately. So, is it going to be shipping? It's going to be handling. It's going to be the person you talked with, the person that is giving the message that's going to be read into the other department in the right place. Oh, it's not the right place. It's not the right department. It's moving along and everything. They're just going at it one by one by one, and they're trying to do it as fast as they can. So shipping has to do with handling. I've dealt with that with Mauser, but yet I was totally satisfied to get things within 2 days with $10 or $20 worth of shipping and handling for $1.50 worth of parts I couldn't find anywhere else. Katie 2, how are you?
Amazon has more parts. Comment.
Yes, comment.
This is KD2BHD, thank you. Very quick. I've used McMaster car, and I'll size the situation up as this. At any time in life, you could be find yourself with more money than time, or more time than money. And it makes a difference. If you want a weird piece of quality hardware, you can get it from them, you can get it quick, and you can get it before you die. So if your time is short and your money is not, it's a good resource. If you got lots of time, you don't care waiting years to figure out who the heck has the part for cheap, it's a different solution. It's a valuable resource, McMaster Car, but it is pricey. But you're paying for your time. So, back to that.
Okay, Jim, I agree with you, and I think they're also kind of doing this to not have people kind of buying one small nut or bolt or what have you. The profit margin, let's say they shank you with the cost of shipping and handling, wouldn't be effective for business. So I'm sure if someone bought a dozen of those things, the total shipping would kind of spread out across them. So I think in addition to the problems of making sure that those 700,000 items are quickly accessible is to charge you an outrageous amount of money. But, you know, most of us aren't companies. You know, we don't buy in lots of a thousand. And so, you know, the shipping fees really hit us. And, you know, some places care and some places don't care. McMaster Car is basically an industrial type of provider. I don't think they make their profits by individual home sales of nuts and bolts and such. So, you know, there's reason on both sides. If you're desperate for, you know, getting the part as soon as you can, you pay the exorbitant money. If you're not, then you figure out some alternative. It's a free country.
Indeed. $43 for two thread adapters, 1 inch long, each of them. Just one's female, one's male. $43 is usurious, I think. I mean, Amazon is dealing with more parts than McMaster's car, and their shipping is free if you're a Prime member. So, I don't know. I think I think it's way over the top, actually. But I may be wrong.
Well, you know, in your situation, you're not wrong. This is how you feel about it. But you can't really compare McMaster Car to Amazon. It's a different, it's a whole different thing. They're not a universal reseller of tchotchkes and such. They sell high quality, near infinite number of variations on industrial parts. And I would assume that 99% of their clientele are companies. So, you know, they're not going to offer sales or anything. You don't call up IBM for a mainframe and say, you know, when's your next mainframe sale? They're selling to different customers than Amazon is, and that's reflected in the semi-ridiculous handling fee. But, you know, their customers are willing to pay for it. If they weren't willing to pay for it, they wouldn't ask anyone for it. But their customers will pay for it, and so they charge it.
And the price for the adapters alone are very high. So they get you both for the price of the product and the shipping and handling.
Well, it's supply and demand, and you know, if you could pick that adapter up any place in Home Depot or in such, well, then it wouldn't probably cost that much, although it would probably be higher quality, because I would assume McMaster Car stuff isn't made in some inexpensive Chinese manufacturing place. You know, what do I know? But it's different. So again, an object's value is what the person is willing to pay you for it, not how much it costs in raw ingredients. Because if I gave you some powdered iron and said, okay, that's the equivalent weight of the adapter, you just have to kind of shape it in the right shape. Well, yeah, you'd be spending the rest of your life trying to figure out how to do that. So unfortunately, for esoteric adapters, you tend to have to pay a premium because, you know, it's not like there's any competition out there.
She asked me, you know, what's going through the adapters, as in, like, fluid. So I guess they sell them to these mega machines or even aircraft maintenance people, and that's why they're so expensive. Anyway, I'll just let it drop. The adapters were more expensive than the coil.
Okay, it's easier to make a coil. You know, you can get a piece of wire at Home Depot, and you just kind of wrap it around a tin can, and you got a coil.
HD, that's true also, which I'm going to do.
KG2RY.
Jim recognized, and after Jim, David.
I guess what I said last time. If you're on the McMaster Car website to buy something, it's because you couldn't find it anywhere else, and they got you, and they get it to you, and it hurts, but you get what you need. There's no doubt it hurts, but you get the problem solved. I got to give it to them for that. Back to Ed.
K2GJE.
Yes, Ed.
Is that metric any chance about 3/8 in diameter, over?
I don't know. You want to ask Rich?
You have to have that you could accurately measure the OD on that thread, over.
I don't know.
3/8, 24 to M10.
What in diameter?
Three-eighths of an inch by 24 pitch.
If you want to convert it to, that's 3/8 fine. But what is M10 in diameter, over?
That I don't know. It's fairly close to 3/8, but I don't know the exact diameter of M10.
WS2, and it's probably 10 centimeters. 10 centimeters and 3/8 are very, very close.
I think
you may be able to take a 3/8 20-foot die and run it over the metric thread. Over.
Yes, if you could raise your volume a bit.
How's this, KB2HAQ?
Much better.
I had a comment for something else with the KRP, but I'll hold on to that. Just something that came to mind with an M10 thread. I don't know exactly what he's trying to do, but I've done this with car repairs, like transmission pans, the bolts, and things like this. You have strip threads. Is there a way maybe you could do what they call a time cert or a helicoil insert? You can actually drill out the thread, drill out the hole, and you can get M10 helicoils. And I know they have them for other sizes. And maybe you can, you know, put in the helicoil or the time cert, and then you can use your M10 thread. I don't know if that's exactly what he's looking for, but that would probably solve your M10 issue. You're working on the part itself to try to redo the thread.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. I've never really done any of these particular machine shop type of things. Rich, did you hear that?
I did. It's just M10 to 3/8. So, which do you convert? Well, I only can convert the M10, but can you convert M10 to 3/8?
I'd be able to by running a die over it, a 3/8 24 die over.
One of them's female, one of them's male. Imagine a coil out of the top of one end of the coil comes an M10 threaded piece, and then the other end of the coil is female, so you can't run a die over that.
That you run a 3/8 24 tap.
KD2FIU, bring me in when everybody's done, because I've done things like this.
Okay, George.
WP2BX, with some comments.
Here, Frank?
Yeah, I don't know anything about machining the parts, but I will say it sounds like a place like McMaster Car would be happy to negotiate a reasonable shipping rate if you were buying, say, 300 gross of the little part. They probably are not really all that interested in the business of somebody buying one or two of these little connectors. Probably just not, as I think you said, Roy, just not cost-effective. They're really interested in the big companies that are going to buy several hundred gross of them and buy them every month or something like that. And with regard to the conversation about how ham radio isn't what it once was, sounds like the conversation my dad's generation used to have on the air when I was a kid, where they talked about how us kids, kids I was getting on the air with, just went to Harrison Radio at the time, or what was the other place for Harvey Electronics or Lafayette or whatever, and bought our radios. Well, they built their radios, and amateur radio wasn't going to survive when all these kids just buy their rice boxes in the stores and plug them in and plug them into an antenna, and they're on the air. And yet, amateur radio is still here. It's different, but it's still here. WB2BX, so go ahead.
Yeah, but it's different. It's still here in a different form, and it'll probably be here in some form, but different for the next generation. It's just the nature of things. You know, what can you do? I think other companies use a different method. They have a minimum number of items that they'll accept. You know, if you want to buy a particular switch, they won't sell it to you unless you're buying at least 20 of them. You know, there was a fan that I was looking to replace some part with, and they wouldn't sell it to me unless I bought 10 fans. I really had no place to use 10 fans, so I figured something else out. It's just the nature of companies that make their profits selling large quantities to industry, and they're not kind of designed for the individual. There are other distributors that simply will not sell to a customer. They only sell to a company name. So there's a lot of that strangeness going on. There's not much you can do about it.
82 FIU.
Yes, George.
Now, I want to complete this with Rich at W2EZ. Are you trying to fix a 3/8-24 stud into an N10 fitting?
I'm trying to do the reverse. I'm trying to fix a M10 stud into a 3/8-24.
Is the N10 sliding in and feeling loose, or is it just not fitting in at all, like it's oversized?
That's it. It's not fitting in at all, as it is oversized.
Try tapping it with a die. It might cost you about $8-$10 for that die at any decent hardware store. I don't mean a dollar type hardware store. I mean a decent hardware store to get you the 3/8-24 die to roll over the N10, which is larger, as I understand you saying, than the 3/8-24 that you're trying to fit it in. So you're going to be reducing the N10 stud 3/8-24, is that correct?
It's correct, but on one side of the coil, it's a female M10, female. So how do I reduce that?
All right, were you going to stud to fitting, or are you going female to female? I just lost it there.
Okay, just think of a loading coil. On the top of the loading coil is an M10 stud, and on the bottom of the loading coil is a female M10.
Rich, you keep saying loading coil. Let's get down to screws and bolts over here. Okay, now You want to go to 3/8 from N10, is that correct? Is N10 stud going to a 3/8-24 fitting? Is it stud to fitting, or is it fitting to fitting?
It's stud to fitting.
N10 is the stud, and it's larger, correct? Get your hands on a 3/8-24 die. Move it down with some 3-in-1 oil, slowly, and you're done.
But then what do I do on the other side, George, where it's not a stud, but it's a female?
That's coils use a tap.
Yeah, well,
yeah, but the problem...